Okay, so we're recording, and we're going to welcome the audience to the latest episode of Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast of the Armchair Dragoons. And with us tonight, the man who can't figure out how to turn off his webcam, we've got Mirth. Howdy, Mirth.
Hey, I have a webcam?
Apparently so, and I think you've got something like taped over it or something, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah. I'm like one of those national security nuts.
Yes, yes you are. And a guy who actually cares about legit national security stuff for the first time in a long time, the endangered species, Craig the Bison. Howdy, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
And welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches. Familiar faces, new home.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
And
you're here with me.
Yeah. and we decided to throw you right...
Martin needed Lewis, and Brent needs Mirth, right?
Yeah, I guess. We decided to throw you right back into the deep end by giving you drunk Mirth. So.
Well, you gotta start somewhere.
Yes. Yes, well, so, you know, Craig, I don't think it's a secret, your day job is that you get to run around in a tree suit and do smart things on behalf of the rest of the country, and so that's pretty cool. But you've also done a little bit of wargaming with some of the folks out there at the schoolhouse, and just sort of curious, I know it hasn't been like official necessarily job-related stuff. What are a couple of the things that you guys have been able to get on the table there, and how has that gone?
Let's see. We did a demonstration of a number of war games for one of the schools here, and at that particular time, I helped James, who's been on your show, run. What the heck did I run? Triumph and Tragedy was one of them. They did Race to the Rhine. Let's see, a couple of block games. The Napoleonic block game. I can't forget that. Napoleon's Triumph, maybe is what it's called.
Could be. If we had Cyrano here, he'd tell you for sure.
What's that?
If we had Cyrano here, he would tell you for sure.
Yeah, I can't.
Damn, that's hardcore.
Yeah, I can't remember, but I think that's what it was. Anyway, James will correct me if I was wrong, but in a couple of other games anyway. So that's one of the things we've done. And then James and Mike at the simulations department do a great job of trying to outreach anyway and bring exposure to war games. They have a brown bag that they try to run every Friday or every other Friday where they introduce different games to the students at the schoolhouse and to the faculty. And so they'll run everything from coin or miniatures-based games to Matrix, which is a role-playing game. So there's quite a gambit that they actually do there. And then as far as, like I said, like my individual contribution has really just been the leading the Triumph and Tragedy demonstration and then participating in the brown bags and then stopping by to have long, pointless discussions with Mike and James in their office throughout the year.
Has there been a favorite of those games that you enjoyed playing or that you a particular session that sticks out in your mind as one that was specifically fun or entertaining or saw a lesson learned?
Yeah, I think the thing that strikes me is Triumph and Tragedy and how quickly people are able to pick up the game and then how quickly they're able to then just sort of be let loose to play the game. And what you see happen, I think, is initially there's some trepidation perhaps about playing a war game or playing a board game, in part maybe because of stigmas of playing games or the thoughts of Monopoly, or I think probably even bigger is there's sort of a, because of the times we live in, people want to do things on the computer or digitally. So when you present something on the tabletop, it seems less accessible. And like any good GMT rulebook, even the relatively easy games have, you know, 20-page or 30-page rules, and so it's, I think, pretty intimidating. But once you sit them down and you explain the basic rules and you kind of hand-walk them through the first turn or two, it it begins to click very quickly in most people's minds, and they're able to just do the interactions and the gameplay. And I think at that point, they may not realize it. Some do, I think, clearly. And I remember I had a discussion with one of the PhDs there afterwards, and he was just like, wow, what a great game. I would have never thought. And I think that's the important takeaway as far as those sort of interactions. And it's one of the challenges, I think, that the tabletop war games has within a professional setting and then just amongst the population in general. And I think it's how do you break that initial barrier to sitting down at the table with other people, some you may or may not know, but sitting down confronted with a lot of bits and pieces on a board, cards and dice and all of these things, and then a thick rule that looks like a technical manual. And I think that sort of scares people away, unfortunately. So once you can get past that, I think the exposure and the experience is sort of eye-opening, and it creates possibilities in their mind that they didn't know existed.
Yeah,
I think you hit a good point because I think that a lot of these complicated, I'm a diehard on these games, but when you get into these more complicated games, I think you need someone who is a game master, who has read the rules and, can just neutrally interpret them for players on both sides. So,
right.
I mean, honestly, some of these games are so complex. I mean, I've been doing this for 10, 15 years, like hardcore, but I can sit with someone who is also an experienced player, and we can argue about rules for hours,
Right.
So to take people who are less experienced, I think you need someone who's spent the time playing the game and reading the rules to facilitate that.
Right, and I think, one of the things you see, not necessarily at any of the schoolhouses in the military, I'm not talking about that, but in gaming clubs, so there's a miniatures gaming club that I've been on and off involved with for the past year plus here. And one of the things that happens is you have teams on one side of the table and a team on the other side of the table. But then you have that judge whose sole responsibility during the game session is just that, explain rules, facilitate rules, mediate disputes over the rules. And I think in the absence of that, just as Martha's saying, that what you end up with is frustration that builds up. And once you get frustrated, you don't want to continue on. And it takes a special type of person anyway to want to sit at a table and play with, plastic miniatures and roll dice and things like that anyway. And so if you don't have that person guiding that process along, I think you're absolutely right. It creates a barrier that shouldn't be there, but is, because I think, I wouldn't blame computers or computer programming, but when somebody sits down on the computer and they've downloaded the latest game off of Steam or Matrix or wherever they get the game from, you can fumble through those rules, you can read through it, but the game itself acts as the mediator there, and so it doesn't allow you to do things that you can't do, or it allows you to do things you can do. So in a face-to-face setting, I think it's very beneficial to have that person that can sit there and mediate.
Yeah, you kind of nailed it right there, and it was a point I was going to bring up is, say you got a 24-page GMT rulebook. Chris, how long are the rulebooks for the 40X series, the Holland 44 or Dens 44? They're 24-page books, right?
Least, yeah, sure.
Or thereabouts. All right, so let's...
With some good examples, to be honest.
Yeah, so let's face it, like, computer games don't ship with printed manuals anymore, but if you pulled down the PDF manual of, Panzers in the Mist, Panzers in the Fog, and printed out the Close Combat Panzers in the Fog manual, is it more than 24 pages? The last...
I don't know.
The last...
The thing is, you can print off whatever you want, but, I gotta be honest, unless you're playing the game,
You're not gonna learn it. No,
you read rules all day long,
Yeah, you're exactly right. Like, the best way to learn it is to do it, and Craig had the right point in that the system, particularly if there's a good tutorial scenario that includes tips and help guides and stuff, that the game itself acts as the teaching tool to show you how to do things. And a board game doesn't have that unless there's somebody sitting across from the table from you explaining, here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. But the level of complexity isn't any different, and I would argue that it's less complex on the tabletop, even for a very complex game. The last copy of Civilization that I got with a printed manual was the expansion pack, the expansion version of Civ 3. And that thing was like a 280-page book. Can you imagine somebody shipping a board game with a 280-page manual?
Well, I play one. It's called
the Swath
Eater. Yeah, well, but that's the point. Like, the only one out there like that is the one we all make fun of, and that's the ASL binders, you know?
Right, sure.
But there's not a chance in hell GMT could ship a viable product with a 280-page manual. It's not going to happen.
Well, and the whole thing is, like, you could ship a game with 6 pages, and I guarantee you that you and I could sit down and we could debate within 6 pages, because that's what we do.
Well, yeah.
So, unless it's very cut and dry and very clear, I mean, I don't mean to nitpick on people, but, I mean, I've got Toad and Sontag sitting in front of me right now, and I read those rules, and I played it with a buddy of mine who was and we debated rules within that, and it's like 8 pages of rules.
Yeah.
So
that harkens back to the...
Gamers, unless the rules are very clear, we will find whatever ambiguity is there. We will parse that and we will find it. And
And the computer game will you know resolve the ambiguity for you, if only to simply arbitrarily decide what's going to happen. But at least it is.
Sometimes you need that. I mean, I got to be honest. Sometimes you need that because if we have a chance to parse things down to the letter, I mean, we will do that. We're hardcore actual nerds.
And let's all hearken.
What is the meaning of is? I mean, that's actually what it comes down to.
Yeah, and let's.
We do that stuff all the time.
Let's all hearken back to last season when we had fun discussing the fact that there is a thread on Board Game Geek arguing over the definition of a rules lawyer. So.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
You can't make that up. They were arguing over the definition of a rules lawyer, which I found insanely ironic and hilarious at the same time. Greg, you were jumping in there.
That's exactly that. I mean, it's the combination of irony and like, oh yeah, and oh yeah, we also do that. Like, I completely own that. I mean, I hate to think, like, I hate to play games that way, but I've done it, and I do it all the time. You know, I'll tell you what, when you're on the table and, like, your Panther's about to get baits, you'll argue every friggin' rule of the book to keep that from happening.
Yeah.
All right, but I think what you're exposing, Mirth, is not just the sort of willingness of gamers to sort of debate rules, but more importantly, and I think it's the critical part of wargaming, is at the tabletop, you are, unless you're a solo gamer, obviously, but that being aside, you're against another human being. And the fundamental nature of human beings is to always seek that slight little relative advantage against the other. And so when you look at the table, and to use your example in generic, if you're attacking my Panzer division, I'm going to try and exploit the framework that exists in order to most benefit me. So that goes back to the rules, where now, because we've got a printed text, we can debate sort of the semantics of the text. Whereas in a game like Civilization or any other games, the computer is automatically going to generate those results, and that changes sort of the dynamic there. And I think that is what happens with tabletop gaming, but to me that is the strength of face-to-face wargaming. Whether you're in a professional setting or you're in a casual setting of people who are simply interested in, you know, historical war games or any form of war game for that matter, or any board game, is that human interaction is sort of what you can never fully capture in my opinion, in a computer generated game, even games that are played live or through email or whatever, is, you know, human beings are complex individuals, obviously, and they're conscious beings who, whether they admit it or not, are very competitive about trying to gain that just little bit of relative advantage over the other person. And so if the opportunity is in the rules, that's what you're going to do. And so, but the benefit of that is it makes you really exercise sort of creative and critical thinking to sort of interpret the rules or to use the rules to your advantage or to move pieces on the board or whatever it is to create that advantage. And so when things are hard-coded, as they are in a computer game, you don't have that same experience. Even if you're in person competing against another person, because that gray area doesn't exist because the computer is generating those results. So it's fascinating to me anyway. I think it's just one of the benefits of face-to-face gaming, and that is the human interaction that you don't get in absence of them.
You said a lot, and I could not possibly agree more with everything that you just said. I mean, to me, that is...
But you'll spend the next 10 minutes trying to.
No. He just captured the essence of face-to-face gaming because, you know, when you can agree upon the parameters, when you can agree upon the rules, that's the real challenge. I don't want to fight the rules. I want to fight the person. And the actual personal interaction, that's the fascinating part, because everybody... You can be given the same set of parameters, the same set of rules, and people make completely different decisions within those parameters. So I don't need to switch up the – what I need to do is, like, we agree these are the conditions that we're going to, you know, conduct this under and then see how it plays out. I find that the most fascinating of all. And, I mean, I've been doing hardcore, like, miniatures gaming for 15 years. And I learned very early, it was very psychological, because people get very much married to their little troops and all that. And, you know, there's a depth of exploration with them. It's like you read historical accounts and how guys would make this, how people would make decisions based on, you know, I don't want to sacrifice these troops. But you'd be playing something in 28 millimeter and you realize, like, somebody doesn't want to see their little dudes get killed, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I actually find the psychological aspect of, even in tabletop gaming, I find that psychological aspect very interesting. It's not that you're just playing, you're playing the person, and you get to know, and if you play them more than a couple of games, you get to understand, like, this person's going to react this way. And I mean, to me, like, they're all games. I mean, I love playing them, they're all games, but you learn stuff when you're doing this, and I... Professionally, or, you know, I'm completely an amateur, but it's fascinating to see, like, you know, and it doesn't even have to be miniatures. Like, I've seen it in plenty of board games. Like, oh, I can't lose that unit, you know, but it's a little cardboard counter. Like, well, you can lose that unit, but so it's a microcosm, and I find it fascinating to play these things out. And, you know, I read a ton of history, and I enjoy that. But when you're playing, you're absolutely right. When you're playing another human being and evaluating, like, you're trying to judge, it's not just the computer thing, like, where the counters are moving around. It's like, why are they doing this? You know, there's a psychological aspect to it. It's really fascinating. So, yeah, sorry.
Like I said, you were going to spend the next 10 minutes agreeing with him after you said you couldn't agree with him more.
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, I wish I could do it. God, I wish I could do it professionally. I think about it all the time.
Well, you never know. I mean, I don't think if it weren't for the enthusiasm of the non-professional, in this case, military, but the non-professional, that wargaming would be where it's at today. Because it takes the enthusiasm of the non-professional to keep the passion alive. I think, because I think if it were left up to professionals, I'm not sure that wargaming would be it. I think it would be closer, more akin to the dustbin of history like Gridspiel. I don't know that there's an overwhelming drive sometimes to keep these things alive, right?
Well, so you're a good example because you gave me that the book on the Franco-Prussian War, which I've been devouring, and now yeah. I've had at any cost sitting here forever, and I definitely want to play that now.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a great history of the Franco-Prussian War by Warrow, but I think that's the point to take away is that not strategy or military thinking or whatever context you want to put in it, while it certainly is within the professional realm of some individuals, it's not excluded from the rest of the realm of humanity to be interested. And frankly, I think it's important more people look at history and explore the possibilities within history, and wargaming is a great venue to do that. You know, I think, unfortunately, and this is my opinion, strictly my opinion, but I think that within society, we get enamored with things that are the bright, shiny object of today, and we sort of lose our perspective of things that occurred in the past. And so anything that rekindles that interest in that information, I mean, you don't know how that's going to pan out. You don't know how your encounters with the history book or a game may lead you to have a conversation with your children and what that leads to into the future or another person's. And so I think that is really one of the important and sort of unsung, aspects of the hobby that we're involved with.
Well, I actually find that fascinating, and this is a dangerous line of conversation, but I feel like there's a disconnect between people who have served and haven't served, and like, if you haven't served, like, why you shouldn't be interested in this stuff, which I find very I game with a wide group of people, and most of us are just nerds, I can be honest.
I don't know that's any necessarily different on the other side, but...
I'm strictly talking in modern times.
Chris, I'll tell you, most of the wargamers who have spent time in most of the guys who have been green suitors who are also wargamers are nerds.
Yeah, no, and I completely get that. I mean, and I think nerds are nerds. I don't care one way or the other.
I think the point I would make is, some of the best histories that are written on military history are written by individuals who haven't served, and that's good.
Yeah, I think you're right.
They bring a perspective to the human dimension of war and conflict and politics and all of these things that occur that is distinct, vital, and necessary outside of just a military perspective or a perspective of someone who has served in the government is going to have a different perspective than, depending on what department or branch or agency they serve in. And I think, the more variety of opinion you can bring to a situation, the better informed a situation is going to be. And I don't think that's any different for ongoing, military discussions or reflections on military history and sort of what lessons can be learned or gleaned. And sometimes I'm hesitant to say that, but in terms of lessons, right? Because it implies that there's something to carry forward. And maybe that's not the case, but the diversity of opinion, I think, is the critical piece here. And I think that is why it doesn't matter if you're a hobbyist historian or you're a professional historian or in the military or wherever you find yourself in life, that the perspective you bring to it is just as valuable. And even if that perspective only accounts in a sales figure, it's just as important to keeping the hobby in the industry. A lot of the great designers of war games, I'm not sure how many of them have military or backgrounds. I think there's quite a few that don't. They are historians or amateur historians who are fascinated by it, and they create great case studies, really, of military operations, whether it's at the tactical, operational, strategic level, whatever you want to look at. And so I think it's the diversity of opinion that's important. And I think that's really the challenge of wargaming today is how do you expand the attraction to get a more diversified audience? Because I think one of the problems you have, and I'm not going to point fingers at any online community or anything like that, but sometimes you get into these debates where you have hardcore grognards. And
where would you get that from?
and by the very nature of how they conduct themselves, you know, they make the games either seem inaccessible or people unwanted to participate in them. And I think that's an unfortunate side effect.
You, from your position, you are very open to less groggy games, I guess.
Sure.
Even compared to me.
No, I've been known to play some non-war games in my life.
Yeah, no, but I think that, you know, I think that you, that speaks a lot to, you know,
well, I think it depends.
More accessible, because I'll be honest, I'm very much, I mean, I'm a hardcore war gamer. I mean,
right. No, and I can appreciate that. I think to me, it's a question of what is it that you're trying to get out of the hobby?
Yeah.
And so for me, you know, I like, and it's well known, I think people that knew, you know, I do like Agricola. I do like Catan. I do like, you know, Magic the Gathering. I do like Dungeons and Dragons, but I also like Advanced Squad Leader, and I like all of the some event, you know, XX operation games, and I like the card driven war games and you know, coins. So in general, my interest is in gaming, and for me, it's because one, I find it to be fun. I find it to be a worthwhile hobby to spend time with, but the real benefits of the game, whether it's Agricola or it is Advanced Squad Leader, to me is that it forces you to exercise your mind and to critically and creatively think about the problem set. And the framework of the rules or the theme that's being presented to you is just that. It's just a theme. It's just a framework. But ultimately, it's about how do you exercise your mental capacities to creatively and critically think about the problem in front of you. And that's really the benefit of gaming to me. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I've argued that that's why, you know, kids play make-believe and they play pretend and they make up their own games. It's because they're trying to understand the world around them. And I don't think that's any different than gamers. We might couch it in terms of entertainment and fun. But I think there's something even more meaningful to it, regardless of your interest. And I think that is everybody needs to have some sort of outlet for their creativity, and games present that opportunity for people to think and to explore options and thoughts and to have some sort of noticeable impact on something, even if it is just trying to figure out how to feed your farmer. Right.
you were mentioning. You were mentioning designs by non-military folks. There's actually a whole geek list on Board Game Geek of war game designers who were prior, or not just war game, it got expanded to game designers in the large, who had prior service. And so there is a thread out there, one of the geek lists on Board Game Geek, that gives you the list of a fairly comprehensive list of folks who had served and were game designers. And so, look, Pat Proctor's on there, got it. Brian Train's on there. Joe Miranda, a lot of people don't realize, he did actually serve for a while. He was an MP. But there's a pretty good list of folks on there. What's interesting are the number of folks who are game designers or heavily involved that are sort of military adjacent. They're folks that work in the defense and security world somewhere, but not necessarily in a uniform capacity, because right. Like Volko, the guy teaches at the CIA at Langley, and I don't know that right. He'd ever worn a uniform. I could be mistaken. I don't think he had, but you know, he's a pretty prominent game designer, pretty well-known game designer, and he's still involved.
Never heard of him.
Yeah, exactly. But he's still involved in that security world. You know, Mark Herman had, I don't think, had ever served in uniform, but spent a lot of years as a pretty high-ranking dude over at Booz Allen. So, you know, in the defense contracting world.
Yeah, Mark Herman knows what he's doing, by the way. I don't care whether he served or not.
Well, but the one of the keys is Mark Herman has done this for 30, 40 years as a civilian at very high levels to where the DOD was, you know, leaning on them to do a lot of this kind of stuff. And so he's got an insight that is different than a hobbyist is going to bring to the table, than somebody who hasn't spent time in that community is going to bring to the table. And that's not good or bad. It's just different.
Right. I don't want to
try to present it as good, bad. I mean, I've only been in the hobby for 15, 20 years, but I know what gamers are like, and I know the pluses and minuses of, you know, that. Whether people have served or not, I mean, the mentality is there, you know? And we'll pick the shit out of anything.
No, I think that's right, but I think when it comes to war games, I think Mark Simonovich, I'm mispronouncing the name, but...
That's all right.
I don't believe that, you know, he served, and I think that's okay. I think his experience in developing war games, his interest in history, has produced some remarkable games. And I think that is really, I think the point that I'm trying to make is that the background of an individual can influence sort of how they look at the world or how they're doing things.
Yeah.
But when it comes to design or being a player or a consumer of war games, that isn't necessarily a criteria that has to be there. And it doesn't necessarily denote who or who isn't going to be either a successful designer or a person willing to try out the hobby. Because I know plenty of people who wear the uniform who have no interest whatsoever in ever sitting down at the table to play a war game. So
I think you make a great point with that. I mean, I know plenty of people who it goes beyond just that, because I know plenty of people who are like gamers in one sense who would never cross over and do, you know, play the games that I play. I mean, they just wouldn't do it. Magic Gathering, you know, or, you know, it's, I don't know. I have to say it's nice that you cross over and play these different games, because, I mean, to be honest, there's that more than anything else. That's where the resistance is. Like, there are people who play Agricola who would never play the games that I play, you know?
Right. It certainly goes both ways, you know? I mean, my kids love Dixit, and I absolutely do not understand the game whatsoever. I don't. Like, it drives me nuts, actually. But I play it because I believe if I stifle their interest, if I stifle their creative outlet in that way, then the opportunity to then direct them in other directions in life, I think, is being reduced. And I think that carries on not just between parental relationships, but relationships with other people.
You know,
one of the guys, he at the game club, he's played a couple of the miniatures games, but he was in there for Magic the Gathering, one of the D&D probably, but he ended up playing the miniatures games, right? And he became sort of a regular on and off, as far as I know, on different games. But it's surprising when you're sitting in the what effectively is a store that it almost exclusively sells Magic the Gathering and some other, you know, products, that, you know, the very presence of that game group, it generates interest in other people, and that's how I think you can inspire other people to pick up the hobby, to at least give it a try. But then the other side of that is you have to be willing to sit down and meet them on a common ground and teach them the game, and sometimes that means you play the games they want to play, which aren't the games you want to play.
Oh, trust me, I've been playing. I played Bolt Action, you know, which is
it's a perfectly fine miniatures game, by the way.
Yes, it is. It's perfectly fine. Not something that I play voluntarily, but if I want to encourage other people in the hobby, then I will play it.
Right. And I think, you know, the interesting thing about Bolt Action is in the game group, there were a bunch of former Warhammer 40K and Warhammer Fantasy I guess, and they were easily able to transition from that sort of setting into a World War II setting. Now, they might not move beyond that, but they have. A lot of them have. And they're embracing playtesting other people's designs on war games or playing older design war games at the table. And, you know, sometimes those introductory games are really, you know, they provide a function within the hobby that I think is easily dismissed of, you know, it's too basic, it's not realistic, it's not historically accurate or whatever, but at some point in time, the question has to be, what do you want, right? And
well, I think you're right.
People, not to talk about you specifically, but if you only want people, in a general sense, to play these sort of highly detailed, highly structured, historically based games, well, you automatically limited your pool, right? Because sometimes people just want to put some...
I agree, yeah.
Some people just want to put their Russian unit on the table and fight a Japanese unit, you know?
I'll tell you what, if you take a 40K player and transition to Bolt Action and they start actually reading history, I mean, that's a win. The game in itself, it's just a gateway. If someone's, like... into it, and that's what they, you know, and they actually start reading history on top of that.
It's interesting because one of the, what's it called? I think it's called Border Wars. It's a convention that's held out here. I think it's at the end of March, if I remember correctly. I think it's the last weekend of March. But, you know, they're going through the process of now of picking out some different games to the demo there, and they're, you know, play testing them at the club, and some of them are designed by players in the clubs and things like that. And, you know, my response always is, it's great that you want people to play this game, but if your game takes, number one, 6 hours to complete, and it takes 2 hours of the game just to get into contact, well, you've already limited that game to new players. You know, you're...
Nobody wants to spend 2 hours just getting into contact.
Nobody wants to spend that much time, and especially if there's a lot of intricacies into the rules and it's an unfamiliar, you know, game system, you know. And so that's where a game like Bolt Action for flaws on some level is great, because within an hour you can teach the rules, you can play the game, you can roll dice, you can maneuver some troops on the field. Take some casualties, give some casualties, laugh, and then you're done.
That was one of the challenges with one of the Saturday night fights that Cyrano had going at one point was one of their colonial era Africa games. They ended up playing it over two or three nights, but the majority of the first night was simply trying to locate and identify the enemy and maneuver for initial contact. And 3 hours of YouTube streaming later, they'd fired about four shots. and we're going to have to come back the next week for the actual big blam that was going to be the fight itself. Now,
right.
Nobody is...
Well, I got to tell you, it does not make for compelling YouTube watching.
No, absolutely not. And the thing is, so again... Craig and I have both done this in various professional capacities over the years. The shaping of the battlefield and that pre-fight sort of time where you're trying to take the time to get some reconnaissance in place to understand what the enemy might be doing, what they might not be doing, setting yourself up to counter what you're predicting is coming from them. That's a really important time in the battle. But if you're an external observer or somebody who just wants to sling dice and blow shit up, it is boring as hell. And, like, I completely get that it makes for a crappy game despite its very, very significant real-world importance. It's a lousy game.
You can extrapolate that out, and that's why, you know, why is logistics always abstracted in games? Because nobody wants to... deal with that minutia generally, right?
Wait, yeah.
So, unfortunately, that's probably the most important part.
I would argue it is, but...
Well, but that's because you're a logistician.
Sure, but it doesn't compel for... It doesn't make for compelling gameplay.
Tactics,
you know,
for amateur logistics,
right,
for experts,
right?
I mean,
well, that's what they say. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, I've done a ton of 28 mil World War II. I mean, I've been doing that since, that's how I got into the hobby. We used to play on, when we first started out, it was like a 4x8 table, and you spend hours just getting into contact, and then it would be like 4x6 table, and now we finally got it down to, like, it was a 4x4, and you're basically in contact to start the goddamn game. Because if you give people that much space to maneuver, they never get into contact. Because right, they're just going from cover to cover. They don't want to expose themselves, so there's no fight. I mean,
you
start playing, and maybe you get like 30 minutes of fighting, because everyone's just like, oh, I'm going from here to here. So,
well, there's, yeah, it's interesting, because I was looking at, some ancient systems, and I ended up going with 15 millimeter DBA. So, you know, one of the sort of granddaddies at this point of ancient miniatures. And the reason I picked it was it's executed on a 2x2 square. If the armies are in close proximity, it plays pretty quickly. And compared to some of the other ones that I was looking at, you know, I didn't need a 4x8 or an 8x16-foot table to put, you know, hundreds of miniatures and all of the things that go with it. And so it's one of the questions, you know, how much distilling down is too much, or how much expanding out is too much. And I think all of us have to kind of come to that spot, like, well, here's my sweet spot. And for me, just with all of the things that I have going on in life, if I sit down on the table to do miniatures or any game on some days of the week, I want it to be quick to set up, to play the game, easy to explain, and then quick to put away.
Yeah.
You know, these are these sort of life things that you have. You know, one of my favorite games is No Retreat, Russian Front, and the game itself is very easy to set up, but it takes hours and hours to play. And so it is difficult to convince another human being, hey, come on over, buddy. We'll sit down and we'll drink some coffee or whatever other beverage you like. And in the course of the next, you know, 6 to 12 hours, we may actually finish this game. And that's not something in today's day and age that a lot of people are willing to do. So it's a challenge, you know.
I love that stuff. My group does too. But even we've realized, like, you can't give people, like, you can't. If you give people room to maneuver, they never come into contact, because we're all experienced gamers, and we don't want to lose our troops. So,
right, you know, yeah. We, but there's a time.
Oh my God, I can't put my guys up there. They're going to get shot.
Right. But, you know, that's a great thing about a game like Triumph and Tragedy. Even though the game itself can take, you know, 3 or maybe even 4 hours to play, once you get people involved with the game, they sort of forget about that time constraint, because there's always something going on. Even if you're not in the queue to make a turn, you're watching what the other person's doing. You're not just physically on the board, you're watching their facial expressions, you know, what they're sort of looking at, because you're trying to read the person, because that's just as informative as what they're doing on the game table. And so if the game is capable of engaging you in that way, you can expand the time that you play it. But unfortunately, you know, some games it doesn't work out that way. So if it takes you, as Brent was saying earlier, you know, 2 hours to maneuver your forces into contact, you probably lost 70% of your audience at that point.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, yeah, other than a few hardcore, you know, you have. I mean, it's not.
Right.
It's like I've recently played a couple of games where, like, I was told, like, well, the conditions are historically accurate. Well, that's true, but it's not a game. It's like, you could play the bombing of Hiroshima. It's not a game. It's historically accurate. The bomb drops. We're dead.
Right.
It's just not a game. So there's, you know, I don't care what historical situation, there still has to be a playable game. Like,
right.
go back and forth with people all the time about, like, oh, this is historically accurate. Well, no, yeah, sure, it's historically accurate, but it's not a game. I mean, I'm just going to die. I mean,
well, I think that's true. That's where people run into that misnomer is they think in order for something to be a competitive game that somehow both sides have to have a chance to win the battle. And I disagree with that from this regard. I think there are times where even if the battle, or in some cases the war, was a bit of a foregone conclusion, it can still make for a compelling game. Let's face it.
I don't need to win, but I need an achievable objective.
No, well, yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. Like, any game about World War II at the global strategic level that in any way remotely realistically models industrial production capacity, the Axis are gonna lose. Because the U.S. never even shifted beyond about a 40% war footing in their industrial production, and the Germans had been at like 85%.
I recently played a game where I literally had to drive a battalion of Panthers down a road until I got shot.
Yeah. But that's poor scenario design.
My first four turns of the game were just driving down the road. I mean,
yeah.
Great. Yeah. Historically accurate. It's Air Accord. Yeah, that's what happened.
But
is it a game I want to play? Not so much.
But when you go to, like, the Alamo, right, it's basic math, right? The Texans are screwed. They're going to lose.
Sure.
You know, it's 180 against 14,000 or whatever. Like, there just isn't enough ammo in the Alamo that even if they hit two guys with every bullet, you've still got 6,000 Mexicans left to deal with, right? It's just, you're gonna lose, but you can still make a compelling game out of it by turning it around to, can you exceed the historical outcome in one direction or another? And that's really what they're trying to do. A great example of that is the Victory Point games, Empires in America. It's the solo game of sort of the French trying to maintain their hold on French Canada with Montreal as sort of their center of gravity. And it's part of the States of Siege system. Basically, you know, the intent is at some point you're going to lose. It's a tower defense mechanism, right? You're trying to hold the tower for as long as you can. And what you're trying to do is exceed what the French accomplished historically. You know, in some cases, in one of the games that I played, it could not have possibly gone better for the French. Like, we would all be speaking French right now if it had historically happened the way it did in that game. But,
well, I think that's why sometimes you have, I think that's why on some level, why tactical level games are appealing. Because I can take any front in World War II, and if I scope that down to a tactical battle between two squads, whatever nationality they are, on any given day at a level of, you know, 10 to 20 men, either side can win that battle. And there's an appeal there of that competitiveness. But when you scope it out to a game, again, like No Retreat, you know, as the German player going in there, you have objectives you can achieve to win the game. But the longer that game goes on, you know at that point, the only option you have is to try and, you know, go into the defensive war to prevent the Russians, but you see that tide turning very, very quickly. And, but you know that as a gamer going into it, the Germans are going to be very strong up front, but by mid game, that tide is going to have turned and it's going to go to the Russians, right? And so I think it depends upon the expectations of, you know, I don't think Brent is wrong, where most people feel that, I shouldn't say most, a lot of people feel that in the absence of sort of, equal footing on both sides, that the game isn't fun or competitive. And then you have to ask yourself, well, if that's the case, then why are you playing really any historical game above sort of a very limited scope, either of a time frame? So the Eastern Front from, you know, around 43, I mean, is the sides are relatively balanced at that point. But prior to that, the Russians are clearly outmaneuvered and outgunned by the Germans, and in post 43, clearly the Germans are on less than stellar war footing to do much more than what they did. So, you know, there's a part that you have to understand going into it, that what you're trying to do is what Grant is saying. Can I alter the outcome either to be the same as what the historical outcome was, or ideally on the losing side, could I better that outcome? You know, it's a challenge when you're dealing with a historical battle or a camp that you can't rewrite the history and make one side win over the other in terms of facts of what happened. But within the game, you can create conditions that set goals or objectives that allow for the game, you know, either side to achieve a victory, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, the point is to play a game, not necessarily to rewrite history, and I think that's a viewpoint that, unfortunately, some of our brethren in the wargaming world occasionally lose sight of. I want to go back to a point you guys brought up earlier that I've run into some on occasion in wargaming, and Chris, I think you have too, that you'll get a bit of a chuckle out of. You're talking about guys who were 40K players who could quickly pivot to understanding the rules and the concepts of something like a bolt action game. And one of the things that's kind of fun with those guys is you sit down and you have a conversation with them about why it is that they want to play a 40K something or Malifaux or, you know, the regular Warhammer or one of the other minis games, but they're not as interested in the historical minis games. And you get to talking to them, and one of the things that always comes up is they talk about how the real history isn't as compelling or as interesting, or they find it to be boring or something along those lines. Clearly, these guys have never spent a lot of time actually understanding the political landscape of Europe between 1300 and 1900, right? Because it's amazing how well those guys can recite the political and interpersonal machinations of the BattleTech universe and which house was dominant at which time before the clans came back and who was, you know, what intrigue was where and, you know, the fox's teeth versus the black widows and all the, I mean, they know the lore of BattleTech as well or better than you're going to find some history professors understanding, you know, antebellum American history in a university level. And so it's clear that they are capable of absorbing and understanding and regurgitating that level of historical detail. They would just rather do it with a made up history than with real history. And I get it, to each his own. I don't want to disparage those guys, but you talk to them and they talk about, well, history's kind of boring. You know, maybe you just haven't had the right people telling stories in your history classes. It's kind of what I come back to.
Well, I think you're right. And the thing is, and I don't want to sound like an asshole about this, because, I mean, I'm a complete amateur, but I played a lot of 28mm World War II, and the way we played it, I mean, it's all squad-level stuff, and it's like man-to-man. And I've always played the Germans, for whatever reason. And it's mostly because I always, like, hey, I'm playing the Germans. Maybe I can do better than the Germans. But the thing is, like, I actually have studied, I spent a fair amount of time reading, like, fucking actual German small unit tactics. And the game we played, like, I can take a squad of dudes, and I can build a base of fire around the MG-34 and maneuver, and I can actually use the tactics the Germans would use, and it was successful in the game. And I'm like, hey, this is kind of cool. Like, I can read about how they did stuff, and I can actually use it in the game. And
right.
So to me, that is, I love that. It's like, hey, there's a reason why they did this, you know? And the Americans, in the same game system, the Americans are very different because the Americans have fucking self-loading rifles and they have BARs, and they just, the amount of firepower an American squad can put out versus a German squad, they, like, double it. But they don't have the light machine guns. It wasn't the same asset. It wasn't a squad-level asset. So it's like, literally, I play against people and they're all like, oh my god, the Germans have an LMG. I'm like, yes, but your fucking rifles fire this, you know. I find that fascinating. Like, you actually look at, like, unit for unit, like, who could do what. And the only reason that I ever was competitive against American players is because they were scared to death of the LMG. But it came to a straight up firefight, you know. The SLRs and the BAR, I mean, I just get hosed. I've got the LMG. That's going to scare you away, you know.
the one thing that the American military has never had a problem with at any point ever in our history is putting huge volumes of accurate fire downrange on targets. Whether it's
accurate, we just put fire down.
Well, no, we're pretty good with the accuracy too. Hang out with the artillery guys for a while. Whether it's artillery fire or whether it's musket fire or whether it's close air support, we put rounds on target better than damn near anybody. Why it's insanely stupid for anybody that lives in a desert to want to pick a fight with us, because the last thing you want to do is give somebody that's really good at putting accurate fire down range a wide open range to shoot in. But you know, throughout American history, going all the way back to pre-revolutionary war times, that was something we were pretty good at. We might dick up a lot of other stuff, but you know, putting bullets where they need to be is not one that we've generally had a problem with.
Well, I get it, and I learned it. I learned it in that tactical level, because I have a squad of, I mean, the thing is, when we were playing these games, it all tended to get, everyone wanted to EQ it out, so I have a squad of 10 guys, so I'm going to face an American squad of 10 guys, except my 10 guys are firing single-shot cars, and I might have an LMG team within that squad. But then all the Americans are firing fucking rapid fire, you know, self-loading rifles, VARs, and all. And then on top of that, because at the squad level, the machine guns, so then we're going to give them, you know, a 50 cal or something.
Yeah.
It just depends on a lot of it goes down to what the level of war.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And I think that just is one of those things, and it's. You know,
Grant is right. We do know how to put out firepower. I mean,
yeah.
That's what we do.
We put holes in targets really, really well.
We're very good at that, and we've been very good at it for a long time.
Yeah. Hey, guys, we're hitting the 1 hour mark here, and some of us actually have to get up and go to work tomorrow. Well, some of us need to go to work sober tomorrow. Let me put it that way. Well, yes. So I do want to thank Bison for rejoining us here on the podcast. That's very awesome of you to come back and make an appearance. We do appreciate it, and hope this is not a one-time cameo, that this becomes a regular engagement for you.
Yeah, hopefully next time on we'll have another good discussion. I don't know how much I contributed to the collective knowledge of the group, but do what I can.
Well, what's great about having somebody like you or Drunk Mirth on is I just have to throw out a provocative statement every now and then I can like lay down on the couch here and let you guys just go. So it makes my job very easy.
To listen and be like, what the hell are they talking about?
Yeah. Eh. It's all in the editing. So,
people play Agricola, trust me. I don't know, not me, but people do play.
Yeah. Well, you know, look,
you should try it sometime.
It's been well established that my role-playing game collection far outstrips my war game collection, in part because there's just so much more to collect there with the role-playing world. Even off of one core set, you can have tons and tons of expansions that way exceed anything that, you know, ASL players would try to brag about. And that's just the physical copies. That doesn't include all the PDFs. But really, I think what it comes back to is what my wife constantly accuses me of, and that is I'm just a pack rat. And she's not wrong. I am.
I'm sitting here in my kitchen right now, and I can look around, and I actually can see, like, 20 hardcore board games, like, right now in this room.
How many of them are in the room that you can't see because the others are in the way?
Well, that would be, like, 50 more.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. What is it? Tackier. I can still see that.
And the beauty of this is you've probably got a half a dozen of them in shrink, and by the time this episode airs, they will still be in shrink.
Well, the MBT games are still in shrink.
You're proving my point here.
That's great. This is awesome.
Chris, have a beautiful evening. Craig, thank you for joining us, and let's do it again.
Absolutely.
audience, please swing by our site, come by our forums. One of the things we do want to pimp on the site is we do have the event calendar out there that has not just conventions on it, but we've got a whole bunch of local game groups, game clubs. If they've got a Google calendar that they share with the public, we try to get it added to ours so that as much as possible you can see what's going on in the wargaming world and actually go find somewhere to play. So we're not just reading about games. We're not just talking about games. We're trying to get you into a game and help you find places to play, places to learn, places to get engaged in the wargaming hobby.
Play games,
yeah. Yeah. Who knew? And then, you know, most Saturday nights we've got something streaming on our site where we've got some guys firing up the tabletop simulator and have some pretty regular games and some reasonably entertaining banter as well. So if you get a chance,
very nerdy.
Yes, check out our Saturday night fights and we'll catch y'all online. So thanks everybody and good night.